This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
COVID-19 has brought day-to-day interactions and retail commerce to a virtual standstill around the world. The Hopi and Navajo tribe have been particularly hard hit, with tribal communities and businesses shuttered. But the world keeps spinning, and the tribal communities continue to function and interact via online and remote vehicles of communications. And hopefully before too long, the tribal communities will return to normal and once again welcome visitors and tourists from around the world. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a visit with Hopi anthropologist Micah Loma Ombaya when we both participated in the 9th Annual Native American Cultural Tourism Summit held at Moncopi in Tuba City back in 2013. Loma Ombaya shares insights about the world of the Hopi in northern Arizona as he leads us on a backcountry tour and discusses the complexities of maintaining cultural integrity in the land of the Hopi. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from the land of the Hopi in northern Arizona. I was recently invited to be a presenter at the Native American Cultural Summit Conference, sponsored by the Santa Fe, New Mexico-based Institute of American Indian Arts, while attending the three-day event hosted by the Hopi tribe at the Upper Village of Moncopi, Arizona. I had the pleasure and honor to visit and spend time with Hopi anthropologist Micah Loma Ombaya, who's also Chief of Staff for the Hopi Tribal Chairman's Office. Come along and join me for an illuminating conversation with Micah Loma Ombaya. Micah, welcome.
Lomantafke.
Tell us about experiencing the Hopi lands and the land itself and what's closest to your heart.
Closest thing to my heart has always been, and you know, I've introduced to it at a young age, was just the land that we have here, our Hopi homeland. It's a large expanse of almost 15 million acres that we call Hopi Titsqua, which translates directly to Hopi land. We established this homeland thousands of years ago. Our ancestors have lived here, and you know, my elders have lived here, and they passed on the tradition of how to survive here, how to take care of the plants, how to use the plants, how to give back to the landscape and the many different forms of life that we have here, and how to take care of it as stewards of the land. So for me, the land is really what's closest to my heart, and how we experience it in our own personal learning in Hopi, as well as being able to pass on knowledge about it. The land out here holds many resources, and they're just not natural resources, they're cultural resources. Myself, being raised to grow crops, being raised to even raise cattle, you know, that's one initial way I experienced the land, but also being out there to understand the ancient peoples and the archaeology of the area.
It's not just simply the land, but its mineral resources and how the land has a relationship to the day-to-day lives of the Hopi people.
Rocks we use to build our homes, the coal we use to heat our homes, and you know, the minerals, the medicines out there.
An integral adjunct of the three-day cultural summit conference consisted of daily field trips for up-close and personal experiences with the land and its resources. Micah Loma Ombaya led us on an expedition to explore Bat Canyon and Coal Canyon in the backcountry.
Bat Canyon, Hahonogai Canyon, it's a Navajo word. These are small tributaries leading into Blue Canyon, which is a little further down. You know, it varies in terms of how far up, but those connect to the Moncopi Valley that we were just a part of. Moncopi Valley runs up about another 30 to 40 miles up to Black Mesa, where it begins, and that's a main tributary from Black Mesa and brings water into this area. These side canyons here all have their own unique geological features. This one here, actually, you can see a good layer of coal extending just beneath that sandstone. We're basically underneath a lot of the sandstone layers that you find the Hopi mesas on. But you can find different seams of coal. You can find different seams of shale. You also see mudstones lining in there, which give it that red color. So a lot of these really highlight the beauty of the Hopi reservation, not just the mesas, but these little secret places that we have throughout the reservation. I bring tours here. I bring even our own Hopi people and children here. Most of them have never set foot outside of the villages or their field areas. And I think that's one real highlight of Hopi is that we have 1.6 million acres. We have 62,000 acres. We have another 900,000 acres that are part of our ranch lands. We need to begin developing and asking those questions of how do we take advantage of that, either to steward it more, to take advantage of it, and how do we take advantage of it in a stewardship fashion? How can we use these lands without destroying them? We have for centuries, but how do we do it now with the rest of the world, if the world wants to come, and how do we control that? A lot of times, many of our students, many of our youth are going into business management, economics. Why are we sending them into those fields when we have a large expanse of land that needs to be managed? We need biologists, we need geologists, hydrologists. We need all those people to be able to help us take care of it. And that's one thing we're not doing is recruiting and pushing them into those fields. All we're doing is telling them to go into business. And that's not the place for most of them. Most of them need to take advantage of the resources that we have here. But also the reason I brought you here is to show you how undeveloped it is. These areas are sometimes pristine and they need to be taken care of.
Stewardship of the land for the Hopi is a central mission, but an equally important question that's being dealt with right now has to do with tourism and how to share and showcase their natural wonderland without degrading or compromising the natural environment.
Tourism out here is undeveloped. It hasn't been a real structured way of doing things. We have some villages that have a tour program. We don't have the facilities to bring in large groups on charter buses. The only place we have on Hopi that can handle a group over 50 to 100 is the Hopi Culture Center. We don't have the restroom facilities. We don't have the parking. We don't have sometimes the roads that can facilitate large groups or large buses to come out here. So how do we take advantage of tourism but also try to measure it against what the villages need as well? A lot of the individual, independent villages have their own rules, have their own leadership, have their own residence patterns and farming patterns. We need to be able to work together to define that for each other. We know each other. We need to share with each other how we want to work with tourism in each of those villages. Some villages have shops lined up along the highway. Other villages don't have that. They have homes instead. What's the difference there? Why is it different? Some people, like some silversmiths or others, will criticize tour guides, yet that's how they make their living. Do you connect the two? You know, how do you connect that? It's really an issue and issues that need to be defined by the people. And the leadership in each village needs to take up that responsibility of not just being seated in those positions, but talking with their people about how and why they're going to approach tourism if they want to. Tourism is going to happen regardless of us being a part of it. Do we want to be a part of it? The trains brought in people, the wagons, the Harvey cars, all that. You know, we're right in the middle of great tourism destination. We have the Grand Canyon, we have Monument Valley, we have the Painted Desert. We're right in the middle of all that. We have people coming through our reservation regardless of whether or not we want them to. It's a state highway. We have to allow public access.
Just like communities around the country and around the world, it seems that every great proposal to build the economic infrastructure for tourism comes with an inherent downside.
Just recently, we have a Hopi Transportation Task Team that is proposing to put a lot of these roads, just like the one we were on, onto the tribal reservation system. And with that comes funding from the federal government, but with that also is a requirement for public access. If you receive those fundings, any of those roads you put on that system, the public is allowed to come through there. And so I just raised that question with our Department of Natural Resources, where I used to work as a natural resources planner and the tribal archaeologist. I'm trying to keep them in line because I work in the executive offices. I'm not in the line departments right now, But I try to keep on top of these issues because a lot of our departments may or may not have access to the information. There's a line of communication that needs to be created. I'll say created because it oftentimes isn't there. This hand's doing something, and the other hand's doing something else. And the main issue that we came up with visiting these canyons specifically has been the issues of tourist magazines as well as tourist websites highlighting this as a destination for non-Hopi people. And they give GPS coordinates, they tell you the milepost to turn off on and all that. Yet, this is an Indian reservation. You know, it's
held in trust. They're directing people to come out on their own.
And it's held in trust for the use of tribal members. We need to communicate to them and provide signage even. And we just came up with this interim policies that you can be here, but you have to be with a licensed Hopi tour guide. It can't be a non-Hopi tour guide. It has to be a Hopi person that's licensed as a guide to bring you out here. And you can only stay on the existing roads that are out here and no off-road. And the only thing that's allowed out here now, we're trying to develop this policy of visiting these canyons, is only walking tours, hiking tours. That's it. That's a limitation we can at least live with right now. Places like Blue Canyon, which is further up, and you can actually drive through Blue Canyon, that road starts from State Highway 264 that we're on and ends up in a Navajo town called Red Lake Trading Post. And so we have Navajo people coming through that on their own. We have Hopi ranchers traveling through that. Sometimes we have tourists that travel through that knowing it's there. You really can't close off that road unless you're going to have someone stationed there with a toll booth, you know, and one of those arms that goes up and down. So I had to talk to the department. I said, you know, you want to make restrictions, but the first thing I always start a lot of my meetings off with the Department of Natural Resources, because I used to work there, is let's begin to tell our people what they can do instead of what they can't do. We're telling people not to do this, not to do that. Well, what can you do? That's what management is about, is balancing uses and non-uses together. The reason I say this is because even people in my villages, like the women, want to go out and collect resources on the range. But they feel, oh, well, that belongs to the ranchers. We can't be out there. No, it's not. They have a particular use that they're permitted to do. You have the rest of that use. You can do the things you need to do out there because it supports our culture. Sometimes we don't understand that. Unless you're a part of the culture and living the culture, you're not going to understand the needs of the people for the land that we've always used, whether it's minerals, plants, animals, all those things, you know. First and foremost, we need to be Hopi. Second, we can begin to understand the economic and other benefits of the land. I try to put that first, but we also have to educate our traditional practitioners or cultural people about why we need to manage in a particular way as well. As long as we get their input, then we can always manage for that as well. And you talked about air tours, right? So one example, air tours, helicopter tours, that even wind turbines, that goes against what we value. One of the things we value that would be disturbed by wind turbines and air and helicopter tours is eagles and raptors. We need to have a stable population out here of nesting eagles and hawks and other raptors because they're collected by the clans. And so we can't have the disturbances that will drive them out of the area. They have as much a right to this as a homeland as we do. And we can't create opportunities maybe that are economically beneficial to undo their good nature and their habitat as well. So we try to balance the things out, but we have to understand why we're balancing it out as well. We can't just say, no, you can't do that. We have to have a real basis for that. And maybe some seasons are allowable and some seasons would be closed off. But there are some places along this seam here that is coal. In a couple of places, you actually have people that created mines into that coal seam and right off the edge, but they create platforms and other things onto the side of the wall, and they actually excavate it into this coal seam and would transport that coal up to the Tuba City boarding school and the town of Tuba City when it was developing. So this was a very valuable resource. You know, they'd come out here and mine it in wagon loads and be able to transport it back up there as well. There is a good benefit to these canyons hiking. There are a couple of ways to get in here. One is Hahonogai Canyon. I'm sorry, my Navajo is a little out. But you can come in there and you can go into some of these side canyons. And the road that we're on actually drops down and crosses into the canyon as well.
The issues and obstacles that the Hopi people have to deal with go beyond their own borders. They also have to deal with ongoing issues pertaining to their relationship with the adjoining Navajo Nation.
There are still Navajo lessees that live out here. As part of the Navajo Hopi Land Settlement Act in the 70s, the Hopi tribe bent over backwards once again. All Hopis relocated from the portion of Navajo lands that they were on that was awarded to Navajo. They all relocated to Hopi. Yet some of the Navajo population decided to resist that. But the Hopi tribe accommodated them again, and it's actually what we called it was an accommodation agreement. We allowed them to sign 75-year leases to stay and live on the Hopi reservation as long as they recognized the jurisdiction of the tribe and agreed to a certain portion of home site or farming or grazing use. And so once that expires, then they will have to, if they're still there, they will have to leave the Hopi reservation. But there are still a few of those people that live out here. Most do recognize the Hopi jurisdiction. The main complaint we have is that they were supposed to be given benefits from the Navajo tribe as well as the Navajo Hopi Land Relocation Commission, and some have never seen the full benefit of that. So that's out of our control. You know, that was a commission created by Congress, and you know, most of the people administrating it aren't under the jurisdiction of the Hopi tribe. To me, what's the richest and most valuable part of the Hopi experience is being out here on the landscape, seeing the precious waterways and the precious wetlands that we have, because we don't have much water, but you know, it forces us to be conservative.
Driving through the country here, it looks like a very dry and desiccated place, and yet you look off to your right in the field and there's corn coming up. How do they do that?
It comes from the heart. It's a way for us to recognize that farming is our central way of life as Hopi. It's a very valuable way of existence in a place that is harsh, having knowledge of how to raise crops in this environment. And of course, what's most intrinsic to that is the seed crops that our ancestors handed down to us. You know, the 16 or so varieties of Hopi corn, the Hopi squashes, Hopi beans, herbs as well, and many of those varieties are unique to our tradition. So being able to foster that, care for it like we do as children, and raising it every year as children, taking care of it, results in hopefully a good harvest. So we try to measure every year and measure ourselves, because the environment can reflect how we behave and how we act with the many different elements of life. So throughout all of this, we're trying to ensure that we have a balance so that we will be rewarded by the moisture that helps us to raise our crops.
Let's talk for a moment, if you don't mind, about people who want to come and visit Hopi land to experience it. How would somebody do that, and what would they be able to see?
As an independent traveler or even as a group traveler, you can always come through the state highways that lead into the Hopi land. And there are some places that are always readily available, like the Hopi Cultural Center and the arts and crafts shops that are waiting to meet and greet the visitor from near or far. But the most beneficial and the most valuable way of interacting with the Hopi is to hire a guide. And the guide can take you into the villages, share the local history, can bring you to some of the artists and even introduce you to Hopi foods, but can also take you to some cultural sites that are allowed to be visited. And of course, you get a guide that's going to explain to you and answer questions that you might have that may or may not be known to the outside tour operators. But really, the local people here will definitely host you well, and as Hopi, we intend to be good hosts.
For the listener, location in Arizona and how typically somebody would come here.
We have some regional cities that people can find pathways here to Hopi. The town immediately south of the Hopi Reservation is Winslow, Arizona. Another city to the southwest of Hopi is Flagstaff, Arizona. And just to the west of us is Tuba City and the Munkapi villages there. So those are some of the immediate gateways to the Hopi villages. A road coming from east to west is State Highway 264, and that connects to the east with Gallup, New Mexico, and Window Rock. So those are definitely ways that people can travel safely to the reservation and, you know, find their way even to other major scenic places. And so we're right in the midst of a lot of national parks and monuments, and really stopping at Hopi and visiting Hopi is pretty much on the way to many of those places that people intend to visit when they come to the Southwest.
At the Hopi Cultural Center, are there motel rooms? Are there places to stay there?
Yes, we have a unique setup here. You know, this Hopi Cultural Center was an idea broached by our elders in the past who wanted to provide a place for visitors to come and be in a secure place, also to be in a place that was welcoming outside of the villages so that we wouldn't intrude on the village life or village ceremonies that may require, you know, some privacy. But this Hopi Cultural Center does have a restaurant that does serve a few items of Hopi food. We have lodging here in about 33 rooms, and we also have arts and crafts shops that people can come to. And what's also nice is that we have the Hopi Museum here. So it's a nice little place to visit and learn a few more details about Hopi life as well.
And this would be where somebody would typically meet up with a tour guide that they might arrange for.
Yeah, most tour guides use this as a hub because it's the most recognizable place on Highway 264 here. So try to aim for Second Mesa, which on top of it is the Hopi Cultural Center.
Now, I understand there is a new hotel that's the first one to be built in Hopi lands in, 50 years?
Yeah, we do have a new hotel at the villages of Munkapi near Tuba City. You know, the villages of Munkapi predate any of the other settlements there, and it's been a strong Hopi farming community for many years, centuries, and we all are honored to see that the upper village of Munkapi has decided to create economic development for itself and the rest of Hopi by creating that hotel, which is fantastic. It's an awesome facility, comfortable rooms, awesome environment there. You have pine beams and Hopi art and Hopi photos and very comfortable rooms. I really encourage people to come and visit and stay there as well. My name is Michael Lamontvaya, and you can visit me and others at HopiTours.com, and you can also experience Hopi at ExperienceHopi.com website.
Excellent. Micah, thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Oui. Kwa kwa.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory, produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. People often associate the Society of St. Vincent de Paul with thrift stores. Donations like clothing, your gently used couch, or still serviceable washing machine generate funds to assist the Society in putting food on the table for people in need, or keeping the lights on and families in their homes. To find a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in your area, visit svdpusa.org.